Thank you to those who read, and thank you, Chuck, for being our timer. Our speakers will share for 15 minutes each, then we will open the floor for 3-minute shares. Please follow these timing guidelines to allow more attendees to participate in the workshop. Give your first name, where you live, how long you've been in OA, and length of abstinence and or maintenance. So our first speaker today is Tony H. Tony has been a part of my abstinence in sort of a peripheral way. When I first got abstinent, I went to a lot of meetings that I saw him at. So I really am really excited to hear his story. Tony, if you have any kind of special timings, just let Chuck know, and I'm sure he can accommodate you. Here's Tony H.
Thanks, Risa. I'm Tony, and I'm a recovering compulsive overeater.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Chuck, thank you. If you will, I'm going to set my timer on this end as well. But if you will kind of keep an eye on yours too, but I'm going to try to watch myself as well. Okay. as I said, my name is Tony, and I am a recovering compulsive overeater and food addict. Pardon me, food addict. I first came into Overeaters Anonymous in November of 93. My time of abstinence now is, let's see, 18. January was 4 years back to back. And I'm very grateful to have that. I came back, or when I first came into program, I got abstinent quickly, or what I considered my abstinence at that time. I got abstinent pretty quickly. The food plan, or the plan of eating that I had at that time, I came straight out of a treatment center, and it was very structured. And I stuck to that plan religiously for 8 years. Back to back. And I dropped to the lowest weight that I had ever been as an adult. Part of my story is also about body dysmorphia and laxative and exercise bulimia. So I'll go back and give some background, and then try to catch up and talk about, do the basic structure that we do, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So when I came in, as I say, I was a participant doing laxative bulimia and exercise bulimia. By the time I got to the rooms, I had pretty much backed off of the laxative bulimia so much, but the exercise bulimia was in full swing. So when I came into the rooms and went into treatment, they didn't talk about the exercise portion. So that was very difficult for me because I recognized, or I felt like that was what I had to do to keep all this going. Because this is a diversity in recovery session, I also want to talk a little bit about that. It was very interesting when I found out that this was happening, that the diversity side of the disease is not something, or the diversity side of my experience is not something that I think about very often. Because, you know, people talk about it being the last house on the block. And when I got there, I felt like it was. When I came in 93, there were very, very few men in the room. As a matter of fact, I had been in the rooms for a long time, and I had only seen one other man other than myself when I got there. And that was a little difficult, but not very difficult, because I was desperate. So I was willing to go wherever people wanted. You know, people were willing to tell me what to do to stop eating, to kill myself. Then I was willing to go and listen to what they had to say. I used to go to the noon meeting a lot at the office, because at the time I was working for the government and I had an afternoon shift, so I could go to noons every day And I would go to the noon meeting, and it was mostly, I used to jokingly call it, in, you know, to myself, I would never say it to them, the housewives group, because it was all women and it was the middle of the day. And that's basically what was going on. What was really interesting about that meeting, I had a spiritual awakening in that meeting around diversity. Like I say, I always felt comfortable in the room itself because I had always felt like I never fit in anywhere anyway. And I used to proudly say to people, you know, I have been on the outskirts all my life. I've always been distinct, you know, yada, yada, yada. So being the only one in the room was not unusual for me. But I remember I had gotten into, I'm a poster child for why you don't start a relationship 6 months into recovery. I had gotten into a relationship in the treatment center, okay? And it fell apart. It just busted all to hell. And I remember when we split, we weren't living together, but he called me at like 4 o'clock in the morning and we had this huge fight. And it really rattled my cage and I was really crazy. And so when I got up to go to work, I knew I had to hit a meeting, and that was the only meeting that I was willing to go to, because the other meeting that was at noon, he and I both went to, and it was at a gay clubhouse, and I didn't want to go to that meeting. So I said, well, I'm going to go to OA meeting. And I sat there, and I'm sure all of us have had the experience of being in a meeting when the gears shift. I forget what the topic was, but somebody started talking about the difficulty that she was having with her husband. And it seemed like everybody after that shared about the difficulty that they were having with their husband. And she turned to me, the woman turned to me, and she said, I'm so sorry, you know, I don't mean to turn this into a complaint session for women, because I know you're here. And to this day, I look at that as an opening from God, because I looked at her and I said, girl, that's okay. I need to talk about my husband too. And that broke the ice there. And, you know, I was able to say what I needed to say to calm myself down, because I was like really freaking out and I had to go to work and I was scared he was gonna go break into my house and all that, but that's a whole nother story. So anyway, that's just one example of how these rooms have helped me to fit in where I felt like a square peg trying to fit into a round hole. The other thing, and because, you know, there is limited time, I'm going to try to skip through some of this and stick with the topic at hand. The whole body dysmorphia thing, being a gay Black man, body dysmorphia is a huge part of my story. One of the things that that has played out for me is the fact that I am very tall and I come from big stock. My mother was 5'11" in her stocking feet, and her father was nearly 7 feet tall. So as a child, I would confuse being tall with being fat. And I can go back and look at pictures of myself now where I was a child and, you know, I was not fat, but because I was bigger than the other children, in my mind, that translated to being fat. And to this day, I have very long legs and a short upper torso. When I was still working, I worked on a machine where I had to key, and I used to have to prop my seat up, and the people would look at me and go, you're taller than all of us, why do you have to prop up? Well, from the waist up, I'm very short. I just have extremely long legs. So for that reason, I was a hard fit. My background is working in garment construction and design, and that's how that started, because it was so frustrating to find clothes. Until I found an interest in making clothes, and I started making my clothes, and that kind of morphed into a business. But anyway, so the body dysmorphia, and then coming out into the gay community, it was 10 times worse, because there was so much emphasis on the six pack, and even before the whole six pack thing started, I can remember when, 29 or 30 inch waist was just cherished. I mean, it was really cherished. And it made me crazy because I was in a community that was predominantly gay white men. With my garment work, one of the things that I found is that ethnicity does play a part in our body structures. Oftentimes our bodies are structured different because of the ethnic group that we're in. And I remember being at a meeting one day, and when that really, really hit me hard, because I was, when I finally did start to release weight, I got really small, got down to 209 pounds. And I remember I had gone to Gay Pride Day in Toronto. It was my very first time in Toronto. Had gone to Gay Pride Day, and all the boys were walking around with their shirts off. And I can remember thinking to myself, if I could just lose 10 more pounds, if I could just lose 10 more pounds, then I'd be under 200 pounds. Well, I look at that picture. I took a picture with some friends of mine that day, and I look at that picture now, and I understand that for my height, that was not a healthy weight for me. It was not a healthy weight for me at all. And that was like the beginning of the dawning of the fact that my body was different in that respect. You know, I'm 6'2" tall. You know, I ain't ever gonna be 5'10", 180 pounds with an 8.5 to 10 shoe with blonde hair and blue eyes. That just ain't never gonna be my story. So, you know, at on some level in my head, that's what I was using as the scale for what I needed to do to look right. I needed to be as small as I could possibly be. And, you know, that's just not going to ever be my story because my body is not structured that way. So it took a long time for me to get through that and to learn that my body is my body and it is going to do and be what it needs to be. Fast forward to when I finally was able to get abstinent. I came in the rooms, I was struck abstinent, and then I went into relapse, and I was in relapse for 10 years. And then I started doing the 1-2-3 tango. 1-2-3, go back to eat. 1-2-3, go back to eat. You know, and that was really, really crazy. January of 2018, I started seeing a new doctor. And we got to talking, and he told me, he said, you are at what we call the threshold. You are pre-diabetic, you're at the threshold. Your A1C is right at what we call the threshold. He said, that's what we call the threshold in America. Everywhere else in the world, they say you got diabetes. So I'm just gonna say you got diabetes. And he sat with me for about an hour and a half, and we talked about what foods, you know, were foods that I should be okay eating and what foods I needed to take out. And you know, I had been through treatment and I had worked with a nutritionist. So I was like, I already know that. I know how to do this. I know how to do this. And I was saying all that. And he, you know, he sat and bless his heart, he sat and he listened to me and he let me say what I needed to say and do what I needed to do. And he went through all of the directives that he was gonna give me. And then he looked at me and he said, you know, from this conversation, I can hear that you know a lot about nutrition and that you do know what are foods that will be healthy for you to eat and foods that won't be healthy for you to eat. He said, so I'm not gonna say no more. What I'm just gonna tell you is this, I'm gonna give you an appointment in 2 months. And if I don't see no difference, I'm just gonna put you on a bunch of medicine. And he said, I'm not going to argue with you, though. And that was the kick in the butt that I needed because, you know, I watched my mother battle diabetes all her life. There are many, many people in my family with food-related illness. And I got news for you. Not all of them are obese. Some of them are extremely small. So, you know, I know that you know, food, in that respect, food, recreational eating is not my friend, you know? So at that time, I started to make this, I made a commitment to myself to go to any length, to eat the foods that were healthy foods for my body, and the foods that would give me the nutrition, that would meet the nutritional needs that I had. I had been struggling at that time to release weight. The weight started to come off. And at that point, I had been there before. So at that point, I had to say to myself, okay, you know what? You are not in control of this bus, okay? You're gonna do your three meals a day with nothing in between. You are going to keep doing what you know is working for you. And when your higher power determines that it's time for your body to stop releasing weight, you will stop releasing weight. If I do a decent amount of exercise. My husband likes to walk. And sometimes we live in a very cold place and I think he's crazy, but I get out there and I walk with him anyway, you know? So we do like our 4.5, almost 5 miles walking 3 to 4 times a day. My food is clean. I see I'm running out of time, so I'm trying to wrap this up. Long story short, that has been the best thing that I've ever done, was to get back to eating my 3 healthy meals a day with nothing in between and recognizing that my body is what my body is. So with that, I'll say thank you for letting me share, and I will turn it back over to the facilitator. Thanks.
Tony, thank you so, so much. It was wonderful to hear your story. I heard a lot of myself in your story, and I think that's really the miracle. All right. So our next speaker is Mike R., a really lovely friend of mine who I love doing service with. Mike, the floor is yours.
Force of the universe, please allow me to say something useful to someone in this meeting. Amen. Hey, my name's Mike. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hey, Mike.
And I'm going to set my own timer as well so I can kind of keep up with where I'm at. The format, I think we were kind of given a general format. I don't know if I'm going to follow it exactly, so hopefully I won't get feedback after. But I definitely want to give you my street cred, my OA street cred. I have had an eating disorder since I was about 12 years old. The event that started my eating disorder was my parents' divorce, and I learned that when I was in a lot of emotional pain, I could eat something and that would take the pain away. And so I spent a good amount of my teenage years in my room eating and reading, like reading books. And I too am a relapse sufferer. I have been in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous since about 1996. I don't know the exact day or even month, but I remember it was about 1996, so I've been in the rooms a good long time. I've been to inpatient treatment for my disease twice, and what that means for folks not familiar with with eating disorder treatment is I paid someone to lock me in a room for a period of time to stop me from eating. That's literally what I had to do. And you would think as an adult, the first time that you had to go through that, you'd learn. Well, that's not my experience. I had to do it twice. And both times I left eating disorder treatment and went right back to eating almost right away. I started back and it slowly sped up over time. I've tried just about everything to deal with my eating disorder, pills, powders, shakes, programs. Talk to me after. I'm happy to share my experience with you. I have years and years of trying to use other things to deal with my eating disorder. The only thing that's ever worked for me has been Overeaters Anonymous. So that's my street cred. I currently am abstinent 7 months. I'm maintaining almost 150-pound weight loss. And I mentioned my weight loss last because it is the least important thing to me. What's important to me is the amount of life I've gotten back as a result of being committed to program and doing the things that I need to do in my life to have that life. So hiking with my nephew in the woods, keeping doctor's appointments, making promises to myself that I actually keep. Those are some kinds of the things that have like happened to me that some miracles that have happened to me in the treatment of my disease. But given the subject of this group, I wanted to tell two stories, which hopefully I will have enough time to do, because I've had good experiences and bad experiences in the rooms with being LGBT. And I have a story where I feel like OA saved my life. And then I have a story where it was a real struggle, but the outcome was positive at the end of the day. So as a gay man growing up in the 1980s, one of my biggest fears in the world was getting HIV. I can remember not wanting to use the bathroom at school because I wasn't sure if I wouldn't get AIDS from doing that. Because at the time, you know, in the 80s, nobody had all the information, and certainly not some teenage kid in Rhode Island. And so shortly after I got to the rooms, like a few years after I got to the rooms, I had been going through a period where I had gotten some weight loss, and I had made several poor decisions about sexual activity. And so what I had done in the past was I always went to a place to get tested. And I would always pay for it, although there were a bunch of places that would do it for free. I don't know why. And so I went to like this any test or any lab test kind of place in a place in Buckhead. And so I went to get tested. And every other time I'd gotten tested, when I went to pick up my results, the envelope they would give you would be really thin, and it would be like one small sheet of paper that would say negative, right? And this one time that I went to go pick up my results, the nurse handed me an envelope, and the envelope was like this thick. And so I instantly knew what that meant. My worst fear was like had come true. And I don't remember after she handed me the envelope, I don't remember how I got into the parking lot. Like my ears started ringing. It's almost like I blacked out, but I was conscious, but I don't know. But I was barely there. And what I used to tell myself when I was younger was that if I ever got HIV or AIDS, I would kill myself. There's no way that I would ever live with that. And so luckily this particular day, I had picked up my lab results on the way to have lunch with an OA friend. And I got behind the wheel of my car, and the thought that occurred to me when I got behind the wheel was I could just drive off a bridge on the way to lunch. Because I just couldn't deal with the reality of having HIV, or I didn't know how to. And that was the only way I had in my head of doing that. I didn't really have another way to deal with it. For whatever reason, and by the grace of God, I decided to, instead of driving off the bridge, to actually meet my friend for lunch. And and so I met up with her and you know, was able to tell her tearfully what had happened and that I didn't know what to do. And that I was, you know, I was feeling suicidal. And that friend, like, I really feel like my higher power showed up in that friend that day, because she had actually left work to meet me for lunch. And She said, just come back to my office with me. You know, don't go back to work. Cause I had left work too. She's like, don't go back to work. You don't need to. And I was like, oh my God, I can't. She's like, yeah, you can. Call up and say, I'm not coming back. I don't feel good, which is what I did. And she, I spent the rest of the day at her work, at her job. She just sat me behind a desk and she had me look up resources for dealing with learning for the first time that you had HIV, which was the thing that saved my life. I really needed somebody that could be there for me and support me through like what was one of the most difficult periods of my life. Like that afternoon was really the most difficult time of my life. And she stayed with me like until like that evening. And by that time, I kind of, she had me make a couple of phone calls. I kind of wrapped my head around it a little bit. Pardon me. And I was okay. I was okay to go home. And I just kind of continued from there. I can't tell you what would have happened if I hadn't had that lunch date that day. I don't know. But because I have friends in OA, I don't have to wonder. Okay, so my second story hopefully will be a little bit easier to tell. I was once in a meeting that, it was a speaker meeting, and part of the speaker's experience in program was about struggling with being gay. And as he started to speak, he was talking about that. And as he was talking, he held up a book. And the title of the book was, It's Okay Not to Be Gay. And part of his story was like, in his mind, like, was recovery from being gay. And so, and this is a great story about why we have a tradition about outside literature as well. As soon as he held up the book, I was enraged. And for those of you that know me, that is like, I don't get to that place. I just don't get angry that often. And I stood up and walked out of the meeting. And if I could have slammed the door, I would have. I was like, I was so mad. And I got in my car and I started driving and I called another friend in program who wasn't at the meeting. And I was so angry. I couldn't speak for the first 15 seconds of the phone call. My friend was like, hello, hello. And I was like, and finally I was able to tell her what had happened. And so while that wasn't a great experience, right, to go through that, you know, I pray that today, if that experience happened, I would speak up for the traditions in the meeting and hopefully maybe change the whatever. That's my hope today with more experience. But the beautiful piece of it is that even though that was difficult for me as a gay person to be sitting there and have somebody talk about like not liking the gay part of themselves or trying to get rid of the gay part of themselves. He knew the moment I stood up, he knew that he had done something wrong or that something was wrong. And he came to me later that evening and directly made amends to me, apologized for doing that. And then on top of that, went back to that same meeting the following week and made amends to the entire group for doing it. And the beauty of program for me is after he made amends to me and amends to the group, I didn't have a resentment. I didn't hold on to it. In fact, I sat in rooms across from him for years after that and continued to interact with him and still saw him as somebody that had something to teach me about myself, about program, and kind of my own journey about coming out. One of the things in, you know, I kind of did some thinking about what I would share today, and I wanted to read something from the Big Book. There is a story in the Big Book about an LGBT member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was this really cool paragraph in that story. It's on page 367 and goes into page 368. I'm just going to read it really quick. He's talking about service work that he was doing in AA. After 2 years, I went on to do a number of other service jobs in AA. In all these positions, I never felt obligated to conceal or deny my sexuality. I've always felt that the representatives of groups in my area were concerned only with how we carried the message of recovery, not with what I might do with my personal life. And I'm so grateful that that has basically been my experience. I have, you know, it always, my personal style is to feel out groups before I open up and share about, you know, dating some guy or what's going on in my personal life, relationship wise, or whatever. And, but anytime I ever have, I've been warmly welcomed by the members of Overeaters Anonymous. And I'm so grateful that that's the case, because I don't have to sit around worrying or creating resentments, because I'm really good at that one, toward people that you know, because it's just not, it's never been an issue for me. And I'm really glad that that's the case. Thanks so much for letting me share.
Mike, oh my great googly moogly, thank you so, so much for your story. I am just so grateful and thankful to have you in my life. And I think all of us can say the same. This is really a wonderful, wonderful experience. Oh my goodness. All right. Cindy is our last speaker. I've heard her share before, but it is always something different and something new. So I'm really excited to hear what she has to say today. Cindy, thank you so much for coming to us from California. I know it's super early out there, but you've already been in a workshop, so I'm sure you've woken up. but thank you so much for sharing with us. Cindy, welcome, and I give the floor to you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Cindy, and I'm a compulsive eater. Hey, Cindy. I'm so grateful to be here, and I'm also very nervous, which isn't really normal, well, sometimes, but I get really nervous when it's like a specific topic, especially this topic, I think, because, you know, I've had a lot of struggle with my sexuality over the years, and I'll get into that a little bit later, but I just wanted to kind of qualify a little bit. I've been in this program for over 20 years. I actually came to my very first meeting when I was 12 years old, which kind of sets the stage to me, like in my mind, that kind of tells me that I was born a compulsive eater. I don't remember a time in my life where food was not everything in the world to me. You know, from a very young child, even like too young to even remember, but I remember my mom telling me stories about how I really, like through tantrums when she would try and control my food, and I would throw fits and I would scream and cry, and she would offer me money, and she would offer, you know, try and do everything to get me to stop eating. And my grandparents would invite me over, and like my grandpa would drop us off someplace, and we'd walk home, and they'd have like the treadmill waiting for me. Like my family knew something was wrong with me and they wanted to fix it, but they didn't know how, you know. And until I came into this program, I was surrounded by people who wanted to help me but didn't know how, because they had no solution to offer me, you know. And I went to different dietitians and different therapists, and they were these like, you know, size 3 like never had an issue with food their entire lives, trying to tell me what I need to do to stop eating, but not how to do it. You know, it's all about, of course, we all know how to, we all know how to lose weight and, you know, eat less, exercise more. And that was the great solution. But until I came into this program, I didn't really even know what my problem was, let alone what the solution was, you know, but I knew that I was different with food. I knew that there was something different inside my soul. I knew that no matter how much food there was, it was never enough for me. And I recognized early on that for other people, that wasn't the case. You know, other people in my family, we love to eat. Everyone in my family loved to eat. And we'd have great celebrations around food and everyone would be around the food table. And then once the food was gone and the meal was over and the day was over, they would go on with their lives. And I was left there wanting more, you know, it intensified, never satisfied. The more I ate, the more I wanted to eat. And, you know, it was an endless cycle for me. And every memory that I have as a child is that of either trying to, you know, do everything I can to get to the food, or trying everything I can to not get to the food. And even when I wasn't in the food, my mind was in the food. You know, my mind was completely obsessed with food, with dieting, with weight, and not even that much weight, because I think from a very young age, I kind of just accepted who I was in a sense. It was just who I was. It was like, I didn't really battle it that much because I just knew I couldn't do it, you know? And I was never one of these people who lost weight. And that's another reason why I always felt like this program, there is something special here that I've never found anywhere before, because I was never one of these people who could lose weight at all. And I came into this program and I had just started, this was besides the one time when I was 12, you know, I was kind of forced into it in a sense. I was very abused in school, physically and emotionally. Things back then, like they would never allow today. And I was put into this independent study program, and the women there told me, you needed to go to Overeaters Anonymous or you need to go back to public school. And at that point, you know, I would have done anything not to have to go back to that torment. You know, I used to like almost make myself throw up every day because I was so I was so tormented just by the idea of going to school. I was literally sick to my stomach. And, you know, at the time I hated those women. And then today I think they probably saved my life because they planted the seed in my mind that there is a place called Overeaters Anonymous. And, you know, I might've not been ready when I was 12 years old, but something stuck, you know, and I never, ever forgot that there is a place called Overeaters Anonymous. And maybe some subconsciously somehow something got through that day. I don't know. But when I was about 23 years old, I'm trying to calm down for the interpreters because I know I'm a super fast speaker. And so I'm trying to kind of pause and stuff. But so
we actually don't have interpreters right now.
So I can talk as okay.
Feet away.
Wow, that's so cool. Okay. So God, I totally lost my train of thought now. So I came back to my second meeting when I was 23 years old, and I had just started a diet, and that diet became my very first abstinence. And I walked into the meeting, and it was a tiny meeting. There was two other women. It was like a fourth step topic meeting, and like I was really super uncomfortable, and like I read the part on like the sex inventory, and it was really awkward, but I did feel very comfortable there. You know, that's one thing that I recognize. It's like when I walk into an OA meeting, no matter what, where I am, you know, I get love and I get acceptance. And that's what I've always been searching for, that I've never been able to find, you know. And those women told me about another meeting that Friday night, and it was a newcomers meeting, and this meeting was huge, and I felt completely at home at this meeting, you know. And And it was a very dark meeting. It wasn't like full of joy and laughter and fun. It was people talking about death and dying and heart attacks and the fatality of this illness. And, you know, that's something that I like really needed at the time. You know, my higher power works in mysterious ways. I felt immediately at home there too. I'll never forget there was another woman there that came in with me, and we sat together, and we were both newcomers, and I never saw her again. I think about her sometimes, and I just like want to cry kind of, because I think like, you know, why did I make it? And I don't know what happened to her. And that's what happens here. You know, some of us get it and some of us don't. And that's just the honest truth. And I'm so very grateful that for whatever reason, like my life wasn't over because this disease almost took it. And when I was 19 years old, I literally almost drowned in the ocean because I was so heavy, a wave knocked me down and I could not get myself up fast enough, you know. And I think back to that day and I think, you know, if I would have died that day, it would have been a direct result of this illness of compulsive overeating. And, you know, fast forward throughout the years, like I went to that meeting, someone ran after me and was like, please come back next week. I promise they're not all like this. And that just tells me again that I'm different, because like normal person would have probably been running out of that meeting. And I was like at home, like there was something about the seriousness that I needed at that time. And I was only 23. So the illness hadn't taken a huge toll on me physically yet. It had to an extent, but not to a very big extent because I was still so young. And I stayed in this program. I lost weight immediately. I was abstinent for about a year or so. I lost 130 pounds. It just like flew off my body. And then I proceeded to relapse for years and years and years. The thing with that story is that I never stopped coming back. And I knew that there was something special here, something that I've never found anywhere anywhere before, because I've never lost any amount of weight. I've never been able to put down the food long enough to lose any amount of weight. And so I just persevered, you know, and I use that as my higher power telling me that there's something special here, because if I would have came in here and just struggled and struggled and struggled, I don't know if I would have held on this long, you know. But I knew that I had tasted abstinence and I tasted serenity, and I had that initial weight loss. And I knew that if I just kept on, that there was the solution here. And that was the difference between, you know, the therapists and the dietitians and people in my own family who tried to get me to stop eating. They didn't offer me a solution from personal experience, you know, and that's what we do here for people. And, you know, I had, my top weight was well over 479 pounds, my very top recorded weight. I had diabetes, heart palpitations, high blood pressure, chest pains. Like I had so many aches and pains, I can't even tell you. And I don't remember them all sometimes. I have friends in this program. I have one close friend in this program who's known me almost the entire time I've been here. She's known me about 18 years. And she'll tell me, I remember when you used to walk and you had aches and pains like all the time, you know? And they don't have to live that way. You know, I've been in and out of homeless shelters. I was in an abusive marriage and abusive on both sides. And I've been able to live a really amazing life the past few years, you know, and I love what the previous speaker said, that the weight loss is the smallest gift. And that's what I always say too. And I've maintained now 240 pound weight loss, but that is literally the smallest gift that this program has ever given me. It's given me a life back. It's given me my ability to look people in the eye and smile at people and feel at home wherever I'm at in this program. You know, I can sit in a room full of family members and feel like I'm a stranger because I'm very different. I've always felt different. And the food is just one other aspect. And my weight was another aspect. And also my sexuality, I've always felt different with that too. And, you know, today I didn't even know I was in an unhealthy relationship until I got into a healthy one, you know. And today I've been with my partner now for 13 years, and she's also in these rooms, and we have the most amazing life together. You know, we have just, based on the 12 steps, you know, we work this program together, and we're able to show love to each other. And when we mess up, we get to admit that you know, and that's such a beautiful thing. And I've honestly, like, I have struggled a lot. I feel like I'm going to cry. I don't know why. I've struggled a lot in this program with my sexuality. So it's almost like, it's almost like I never say no to service, but I don't particularly like speaking like for certain topics. And this is one of them, because I don't know that I can just be myself, but honestly, I've struggled a lot with my own sexuality over the years. And that's just the honest truth. And there is a part of me today that still doesn't fully accept myself, and that's just how it is. And maybe I just need to accept that I'm always going to have that little part of me. But, you know, just like with the food and with the steps, we strive for spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. And I'm way better than I used to be. And you know, I'm very grateful to be in this program, and I'm very grateful that I found my partner, and she truly is the love of my life. And I don't even really identify as, I actually joke around, her name is Kim, so I call myself a Kimbian. You know, I don't really identify either way, but that's just something that's always made me different. I also have a lot of people in my family who are very religious, and, you know, when we'd be at family gatherings, you know, they'll, like, pray things about, like, you know, really religious type prayers that talk about, you know, all our sins and, you know, all this stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking, they're talking about me. They're talking, because everyone's talking about me, you know, nothing could happen without the world revolving around me. And, you know, it's kind of funny. The very first time I took my partner for a family get together with my entire family, I must have built it up to be that, you know, in my mind, things are so much worse than they actually are in reality. So we go into this family gathering, and then, you know, everyone's very accepting, hugging us, and very cordial, like, outright. And, you know, and I'm like, but I know the truth. I know how you really feel. I saw that Facebook post, you know, like, that's, like, in my mind. And then at the end of that, my partner was like, I'm really surprised that they were so accepting. I thought they were going to, like, walk around with their Bibles the way you talk. And, like, I thought they would, like, you know, like, tell us, like, all these different Bible verses and tell us that we're going to hell and all these different things, just the way that you set it up. And it's like, oh, maybe things aren't what they seem in my head, you know, thankfully, because my head is a scary place and I shouldn't go there alone, you know. And, you know, today I get to recognize that I am who I am, whoever that is. And it does, and I don't even need to know 100% who that is, but I can just be me, and I can just try my best to be the best version of myself and accept myself and believe, even if I don't always believe, but at least act as if I believe that there's a higher power out there who accepts and loves me 100% exactly as I am, just like you guys have shown me.
Cindy, thank you so, so much for your share. And thank you to all of our speakers. Wow, this has been a really great workshop so far. All right, so thank you to wait, nope. Okay, here we are. We will now have open sharing and questions. If you'd like to share, please use the raise your hand function by clicking the reactions button at the bottom of the screen and choosing raise hand. If you're on your phone, find it under more than reactions. If you can't figure out how to raise your hand, type your name in the chat and say you want to share, or say your name in between shares if on your phone. Please recognize the timer when you hear it and quickly wrap up your share. The floor is now open, and I'm going to turn things over to our participant minder, Becky.
No hands yet.
Oh,
Chuck, thank you.
Hey, I'm Chuck. I'm a compulsive overeater. So that was about as much emotion as I've heard in a workshop. That was really good. Some really good stuff. I enjoyed every bit of it. And one of the things I notice when I'm working with people is we all seem to have that deep-rooted sense of not being good enough in this world. And it's happened many times with me, particularly with a guy sponsee that's gay. And I'll hear, you know, right before we get just step four, they'll start introducing that they're gay. And a lot of times it's said with such, I mean, it's almost pitiful. There's so much shame. I think some of it is they feel like they're going to be rejected. I don't know what a lot of it is, but I always struggle with that. I just keep quiet and I listen, but sometimes I feel like I need to reassure them and that kind of thing. So I don't know if that's a well-formed question, but what do you guys think about that?
I guess I'll take that one. I'm still Tony, still got it. Chuck, thanks for the question. The first thing that comes to mind with that question is I know for, and I'll speak from my own experience. I had to, and oddly enough, coming into 12-step programs helped me a lot with this. I had to accept myself before I could accept, you know, before I could expect anybody else to accept me. When I came into program, the treatment center that I went to, I was talking to somebody about this last night. They had an attachment to the program called Common Steps, and they actually mandated that I go to LGBT meetings because of the fact that I came into recovery at 35. I think I was 35 years old. And in that amount of time, I had mentioned being gay to exactly 5 people in my life. And it was very, very difficult for me and there was that thing of, if I tell you who I really am, you are going to leave me. So for me, what I know is that that's an inside job. And being in the rooms helped me. And there were people, there were like a lot of people in my life that were very helpful with that. I have a cousin, and I remember talking to him, and I would do the thing where I would use the non-specific pronouns, they and all of this. And one day he would come over to me, and I was remodeling a house at the time, and he would come over and help me remodel the house. And he was only one of the people who had this kind of a reaction. One day we were standing talking, and I got tired of changing pronouns. And I said, you know something, I'm sick of this. I just need to tell you I'm gay. He said, I've known that for years. I was just waiting on you to tell me, you know? And that people who that was their response or the way that they acted, that helped me a lot on the road of acceptance of myself. I hope that helps you out. But yeah, that is what I found. It's an inside job. Thanks.
Anybody else care to work on that question that Chuck gave us or share something else?
Hey, my name is Mike. I'm a compulsive eater.
Mike.
I mean, the only thing I would say is considering that National Coming Out Day is just this week, it's kind of a timely question. I mean, I think that my opinion is that one of the struggles that we as LGBT people have is that, you know, is going through the coming out process. Like, I don't know, I had to do it with being gay and with having an eating disorder. And so I feel like it's kind of like, there's just another layer. I mean, even I came out to my family and friends when I was 18, but even then, like, it took me years and years to get to kind of what Tony was talking about, you know, a sense of acceptance of myself. So, you know, I'm not sure if that's exactly answering the question, but I do think that's kind of the double whammy that I faced as a gay man.
Thank you, Mike. Anybody else care to share today?
I will.
Sorry. Didn't see your hand. It's blended with your books.
Oh, I have a very busy background. Come on, let's all admit it. Hi, I'm Risa, a recovering food addict. And there was something that you shared about, Mike, that just really struck me. You were talking about like the a person could hate that part of themselves. And that really struck me because, I mean, the truth is that like when I got into the rooms, I felt like what I needed was to change everything about myself. I had an addictions counselor and he said, well, you're a very contemplative person. And I was like, how do I fix that? What do I do? Do I take action? What action? And he was like, I'm just describing you, you know? And I think that that's something that it might be specific what the specific thing is I don't like, but the not liking, and Chuck remarked on it too, that not liking thing about me has been such a big part of my program, such a big part of admitting the truth about myself. And what has really transformed for me over the last years is that I've started liking myself more. I've just started accepting those things with humor, you know? It used to be, I just had so many secrets and they weren't even like particularly salacious. They were just things I thought I could never tell anyone about who I am. And you know, I tell people all the things about who I am, probably too many things, right? Probably too many things, but I just don't worry about it like I used to. I'm not afraid of it like I used to be. And it is such an incredible transformation and something that really happened completely without me knowing, completely as a side effect, right? If anybody had said to me, well, you know, the best thing about going to Overeaters Anonymous is that you're going to like really enjoy, you know, the fact that you struggle with organization, like it's going to become a fun puzzle. And I was like, bitch, you have got to be kidding me. I got some weight to lose. And it just happens that way. It has happened that way for me over and over again. I just really feel so grateful for that. And that struggle that man had, I really get it. Like, it feels so, because, you know, I thought for a long time that if I could just lose enough weight, I wouldn't have like the barrel chest I got from my dad. You know, if I just lose enough weight, maybe I'll be petite and comely, like all these little girls running around. No, I'm a tall ass bitch. And I am like direct and I have a big voice. And it doesn't matter how much weight I lose, I'm still going to be all those things. And now what I have is that I like those things about me. And it just fucking knocks me out all the time. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks, Risa. Linda, would you like to share next?
Yes, and it's Linda Claire. But everybody does. Everybody does.
I thought that was everybody's name. So sorry, Linda Claire.
Don't worry, everybody does it. This is harder to admit than I'm a lesbian than this, but my first meetings were in 1978. That means I'm old now. But in the 70s, people weren't out like they are now. It isn't that I'm not proud. I don't know if that's the word. Accepting. I'm accepting of who I am and my sexual preference, but I'm still have that 1970s feeling about everybody else. And I don't know if that gets into people pleasing or, I mean, we could really get in depth with this, but I'm still hesitant. But when I first came in, as I said, in the 70s, it was not as accepted. But eventually, slowly, I came out to everybody. And certainly when you're first coming in, you get a sponsor, you've got to say, I mean, you can't tell anybody about your life when you have a partner that's living with you. At work, that partner was my roommate, but really, that was my partner. We didn't have marriage then, but anyway, I was with that person for 16 years. And eventually, my OA friends were my friends, and she came along for the ride for social things that OA people had. And that was nice and helpful for me, because it was helpful for me for my OA friends to know her, so I could really talk about it and they could identify. Today, I looked at the schedule and thought, should I go to this gay meeting or not? I don't have any problems with it. I don't have anything to say, and here I am saying it. What do I need more, the steps or the, and I don't need either one more, but I'm still hesitant. I live in an independent senior living place. So I'm not, and I just admire people on my floor. They're similar age. They shave their head and have stickers all over their car. I'm just not that person. And I'm just hesitant to tell 85-year-olds that I'm gay. And I know that's whatever that word is about specifying something because you're 85. If you know what I mean, there's a word for that. Anyway, I'm glad to share about this. I didn't think I would. Frankly, I didn't think I'd be even at this meeting, but I enjoy the speaker so much. It was so great. Thanks.
Thank you, Linda Claire. Carrie B., would you like to share next?
Yes, I would. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Carrie, and I, too, still have it. I just wanted to say that when I first came into OA, my first meeting was the Monday night meeting back at when it was in the main office. And it was the anorexic bulimic meeting. And I remember, I remember feeling a lot of shame because I was overweight, but I was also wrestling with a wicked case of bulimia. And I was embarrassed because I didn't look like what you think a bulimic should look like with what people think a bulimic should look like. And I don't know, this meeting this morning just gave me vibes of that old meeting. It was a meeting where we had a core of people who really supported each other. And I learned an awful lot about recovery during that time. And really, I just raised my hand because I wanted to tell the speakers this morning, every one of you said something that is going to change something I've been struggling with. Each one of you. And I thank you so much for your vulnerability, your willingness to be vulnerable, and the honesty and the laughing. Have to have that in there. But I haven't been struggling with the food, but my head has just been one big old struggle muscle. And I'm going to walk away from this meeting feeling more peaceful and more accepting. And it's really because of our speakers this morning. So I just really wanted to thank you from the heart of my bottom. That's all.
Hope, would you care to share next?
Yes, I'm Hope. I'm a compulsive overeater. And thank you to the speakers and all of you. I was so touched. Many years ago, when I moved to Atlanta, I was already in OA, and I went to a meeting at Windy Hill Hospital on Monday nights. Some of you might remember. And I got a sponsor there. And when she found out, I confided in her that I was a lesbian. And since this was 39 years ago, she fired me. She said, I don't think I can be your sponsor. And it really hurt. However, I had also made a slew of new friends in Atlanta that happened to be gay, and they invited me to an OA meeting that was especially for gay people. And I knew I had found my tribe, not only with OA, but with the gay community, which I really needed at the age of 22. I had covered up my sexuality, my feelings, everything with the food. Because after all, when you weigh 250 pounds, like I did, I didn't feel sexual. It was an easy way to cover it up. And I came into OA in Tucson, Arizona. I had two pairs of pants that fit me. One pair was powder blue polyester pants, and the other was hot pink. And for this Diesel Dyke lesbian that I have finally been okay with all these years later, I came into OA and I had friends at last. I had a group of little old ladies at first in Tucson, Arizona, and they just took me under their wing, gave me rides. I didn't have a car. And when I came out later to my parents at age 22, my mom says, "Well, don't tell your father or your brothers, Hope." And my father, when I told him later, said, "Well, I know there are people with those kinds of problems." So needless to say, my OA family was so important to me for every reason. It was my family. And the people sharing here today really touched that part of me that knows that this is my real family. I am related by blood to some other people, but this is my real family. And I've been able to be abstinent for over 30 years, imperfectly, but I keep coming back one day at a time. I've been married now for 10 years. I've been with this person for 16 years, and we haven't killed each other yet. So I'm glad to be here today. Thanks.
Recent, we're at 10:45.
We are. Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone for a great meeting. I just want to say thank you to everyone who is of service today. Thank you, Carrie and Dion, Hope, Rebecca, Chuck. And thank you so much to Cindy, Mike, and Tony. You have really changed our hearts.